Next up on This Week in Law, Mike Keyes joins me. I'm Denise Howell, and our guest, Margo Kaminsky. We're going to discuss whether cats can have IP rights, but not macaques. Does Niantic need a license for Pokemon Go players in parks? Can you blast away at drones on your property? And does it matter if that drone was properly permitted under the new FAA rules? Have all the copies of The Precious been destroyed? We'll ponder these questions and many more today on the show.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for This Week in Law is provided by CashFly at CacheFly.com.
This is TWiL, This Week in Law with Denise Howell, Emery Roan, and Mike Keyes. Episode 358, recorded September 2nd, 2016. Grumpy PETA. This episode of This Week in Law is brought to you by Wealthfront. Wealthfront is a low-cost automated investment service and the most sophisticated way to invest your money. Whether you've got millions or you're just starting out, visit wealthfront.com/twill and sign up to get your free personalized investment portfolio. That's wealthfront.com/twill. And by FreshBooks, the super simple cloud accounting software that's giving thousands of freelancers and small businesses the tools to save time billing and get paid faster. Try it free at freshbooks.com/twill. Hi, folks. I'm Denise Howell, and you're joining us for This Week in Law. Welcome back to the show if you're one of our regular viewers or listeners, and welcome to the show if you're not. We're thrilled that you could join us. We get together each week with some very smart folks to talk about all of the interesting developments that technology imposes on the law and that the law imposes on technology. They tend to have uncomfortable collisions from time to time, and we're very fascinated in those collisions. Mike Keyes, my co-host, is here. Hello, Mike.
Hello, Denise. Great to be with you, as always.
Great to see you again. Mike is a partner with the Dorsey firm in Seattle and a co-author of that firm's The TMCA blog, focuses on all kinds of IP, copyright, trademark considerations, and litigations. Great to see you again.
Likewise. Great to be here.
And joining us again on the show is Professor Margo Kaminsky. Professor Kaminsky teaches at Ohio State University's Moritz College of Law, where she focuses on media freedom, online civil liberties, international intellectual property law, legal issues raised by AI and robotics and surveillance. She's the former executive director of the Information Society Project at Yale Law School as well. Great to see you again, Margo.
Thank you so much for having me, Denise. This is a really fun set of topics to talk about today.
I know, right? I can't wait to get into them. So let's go ahead and do that, and we're going to start on the copyright front. So as we've mentioned many a time on the show, the famous macaque Naruto, he of monkey selfie fame, is still involved in the court system, despite the fact that the U.S. Copyright Office came out some time ago and said, hey, you know, if the photograph is taken by an animal, this is outside of the realm of copyright law. The Copyright Office didn't specifically mention adorable Naruto. There he is. But clearly had that in mind in making this proclamation. So that bit of wisdom or opinion is out there from the Copyright Office, but hasn't stopped PETA from bringing a lawsuit on Naruto's behalf, claiming that the money that's being generated from the adorable monkey selfie, the rights to which are claimed by the photographer and the photographer's business. I'm sorry, the photographer was actually the monkey here, but the guy who owned the camera, okay, we'll call him the photographer. They are the putative owners of these images, but PETA thinks that they should be and would like to recover monies for Naruto and Naruto's family and donate money otherwise to macaque preservation, habitat preservation, and the like. So that case is actually pending in the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. We've discussed that on the show. Various briefs are being filed, and the Ninth Circuit will weigh in on those issues. So it's far from gone away with the Copyright Office's proclamation, and it may be that we wind up seeing this case not only get some different commentary and precedent from the Ninth Circuit, but perhaps eventually the United States Supreme Court. So these interesting issues aren't going away. And in fact, you know, we have some other stories in our rundown today that might make you question or wonder about how this is all going to go down. So, Marco, why don't we get your take on the Ninth Circuit case and PETA's chances here?
Sure. So the big hurdle that PETA faces when you're talking about this as an actual practical case is exactly what you mentioned, which is that the Copyright Office, when it published its latest compendium, explained that it would not register anything for copyright unless there was a human author. So that was a pretty explicit, "we're not taking this seriously" nod from the Copyright Office. But if you want to get into the real legal weeds, the question is how much deference the Copyright Office is actually owed in its interpretation of copyright law when it comes to registration. So if a court decides that the Copyright Office isn't owed any deference at all, there's a possibility that Naruto's case goes through. The other thing I just want to flag that's really interesting is that the PETA version of this case is this weird intersection of animal rights law and copyright law. It's not strictly speaking a copyright case, even though it is, because the kinds of briefs that PETA is using now as amici are briefs like the one that was submitted by a primatologist arguing that Naruto has all of the qualities of a human author, or at least comes very close to having the qualities of human authorship. So this is less about, you know, the scope of copyright law and now becoming more an argument about the scope of what it means to be human.
Right. And for those who want to read the brief, I encourage you to do so. But if you're looking for a slightly summarized version of that brief and its author, Justin Marceau is his name, the primatologist, and he has a piece at Quartz that is included in our discussion points for the show. Those are available at tagpacker.com/user/thisweekinlaw. We also now have a Flipboard magazine for the show. So if Flipboard is your thing, find me. I'm at D Howell on Flipboard, and you'll find our This Week in Law magazine there as well. So if you want to read the primatologist's take on it, he makes a very sort of planet of the apes sort of approach of the rights and abilities of these kinds of animals, points out that animals can be authors of valuable works of art, that zoos sell pieces of art created by their animals to raise money for the zoos. So this is how we're honing in on this kind of, yes, if animals are authors, then, you know, what sort of rights do they have and who gets that money? I mean, it's sort of an artifice to say that the animal has rights because the animal can't administer their own rights. Right, Margo?
Right, but PETA would be very happy to administer the rights and the funding for him. What I think is really also interesting about this case, and I use it in my intro to IP class this way, is that it's a really good sort of window onto the issues involved in authorship by artificial intelligence. Because if you substitute AI for Naruto in this argument, it's almost the exact same set of both policy and legal issues, although without the animal rights component. Instead, you get into sort of an AI rights world, which is bizarre. But when the Copyright Office says, for example, that for something to be registered with the Copyright Office, there must be a human author, that also precludes registration of works by AI authors. And there have been a number of people who have argued for the ability of AI authors to produce copyrightable works.
Well, I think that's just fascinating. I'm so glad you're teaching that in your class, because there are a bunch of businesses these days, and will be more, no doubt, that are all about using AIs to generate creative works. I just redid my website with a website company that touts the fact that it's using AI to design the sites. And we've talked about these kinds of things in the music arena, the video game arena, that AI is more and more becoming a tool that creators use to enhance their own creativity, or possibly offshore or outsource the creative process entirely. So just as Naruto, the wild monkey, I'm sorry, macaque, with no owner, has no ability to administer or even know that humans are granting him rights, how do you think this burgeoning world of AI creativity will be treated if the Copyright Office is right and a human has to be the author? Are there no copyrights in these AI created works?
So that was the argument that I think it was Pam Samuelson made an impressive number of years ago, was that you shouldn't grant copyright in AI generated work, in part because it's too hard to figure out how to license AI generated work. Anne-Marie Bridie, who's a professor at University of Idaho, wrote a really interesting proposal where she says, instead, you should treat AI-generated works, when we're talking about stronger AI, right? Not AI that's just clearly the tool of a human author, because AI that's a tool of a human author is pretty clearly, you know, copyrightable under that own author's authorship. But Bridie was suggesting we treat this as a work made for hire, with the idea that if the human author commissions basically the AI to create a certain type of work, you could actually have the authorship still rest with the human author and therefore still be copyrightable. But she notes you have to tweak copyright law slightly to make that happen.
Mike, how's your brain melting down around all this?
Well, as we've talked about before on this show, I'm very skeptical about the authorship claims with respect to the Naruto, for the reasons as expressed by the Copyright Office and otherwise. Of course, the whole reason we have a copyright statute to begin with is because in the Constitution, the founders deemed it necessary to allow Congress to establish laws that would protect for limited times the rights in writings and discoveries of authors and inventors. I can't possibly imagine that it was anybody's intention that an author could be anything other than an actual human being. So I'm very, very skeptical about these authorship claims. But the other thing that I'm always intrigued about when we talk about Naruto is, why does PETA believe that it can essentially insert itself into the case and establish rights for Naruto? I mean, how do we know if Naruto has intelligence? Maybe Naruto doesn't believe in copyright. Maybe Naruto, would like to dedicate his work to the public domain. I mean, Who is PETA to be able to step in and assert these rights? Why couldn't I, Mike Keyes, say that I'm stepping in on behalf of Naruto to assert these claims? So in addition to the authorship claims, I think you got all sorts of claims here, or all sorts of issues associated with who has the rights to bring such a dubious claim to begin with.
Yes, definitely. Well, hopefully the Ninth Circuit and perhaps ultimately the Supreme Court will be able to shed some further light on those thorny issues. For the time being, though, I'm kind of curious if whether the beast or creation, artificially intelligent creation in question, has some sort of overseer or owner, makes a difference in these kinds of outcomes. Because also in our rundown is a story about Grumpy Cat, suing something called Grumpuccino, which makes coffee, for copyright violations. Apparently, what happened here, Grumpy Cat had licensed some rights to Grumpuccino, and Grumpuccino ran with those rights and more. They had permission to use the Grumpy Cat brand and other things in their marketing, obviously the creature's name and likeness. So we get into perhaps another body of law there beyond copyright and whether animals can assert that body of law. But it's a weird situation because the Grumpy Cat folks apparently sued Grumpuccino for copyright infringement, trademark infringement, cyber squatting, breach of contract, and various other claims, and got a default judgment against them. So now they are attempting to make something out of that. Grumpuccino apparently went beyond the scope of their licensing agreement, got a little aggressive there. So, Mike, how do we square the fact that PETA can't assert rights on behalf of Naruto, but Grumpy Cat's owners can do so vis-a-vis this very sad, angry-looking cat?
Yeah, to me, if I understand the facts related to the Grumpy Cat dispute, I think the case is easily distinguishable. With respect to Naruto, we have PETA that's claiming that the macaque Naruto is an author and enjoys mm-hmm. all the benefits associated with the copyright statute. Mm-hmm. Here, as I understand it, we have actual human authors that would have taken and copyrighted various images of Grumpy Cat, mm-hmm. also used those in commerce to create a Grumpy Cat brand. So behind the scenes here, even though the centerpiece of the brand is an animal and there's animal images that have been protected by copyright, I think this is all as a result of human endeavors. So I think it's quite easily distinguishable from the Naruto case.
Yes, I agree with you, and I'm glad that you've explained it for our listeners and viewers, because I think it's, you know, as we get into animals and images of them and who has the rights, I think it starts to get a little confusing. And in fact, this is why we feature every week an animal selfie of the week and try and puzzle out what's going on with that. Hey, Margo, go ahead.
One other thought on the whole Naruto bit.
Yes.
Remember that under the copyright statute, the copyright owner has an election between actual damages and statutory damages. It's always been curious to me as to how PETA is going to suss that out as to what Naruto really wants. Would Naruto want to obtain actual damages for this alleged infringement, or would he elect to receive statutory damages as a result? I don't know.
Yeah, Margo, how do you think that? Well, we've had a trial on the case, but in that particular trial, damages were not awarded. It went the other way, so the no trial court has had to grapple with that issue yet. What do you think would happen, Margo?
So I'm not going to directly answer the statutory damages question, but what I will say. First of all, I think that Stoic Squirrel on the IRC channel is correct. The difference between the two cases is that the Grumpy Cat case doesn't try to establish personhood in the cat, right? And Naruto is all about trying to figure out whether there's personhood in the monkey. Macaque. But in Grumpy Cat, what would be interesting and where you would end up in a personhood conversation, and this is a hypothetical, this is not what the case is actually about, would be if there were an attempt to find a right of publicity in Grumpy Cat. Mm-hmm. So if somebody never entered into the licensing agreement and somehow saw Grumpy Cat out there walking in the world and took a photo of Grumpy Cat without permission, the question is whether they would be able to use that shot. So that would still be a personhood conversation, even if it's not, you know, directly parallel to the selfie part of Naruto. So going to like the bigger questions that are raised by the statutory damages conversation, I'm just going to push back a little bit and say that we have legal personhood in many parts of the legal system where we do actually figure out how a real live human person sues on behalf of something with legal personhood, even if it's not human personhood. So when you talk about corporations, for example, there are human representatives. Those human representatives make decisions on part of the corporation. They house money for the corporation. They have various duties towards the corporation as a whole. And it's not totally outside the realm of possibility for that kind of thing to be set up for either animals or artificial intelligence. I do think there are major, just to show my hand, there are major policy questions about whether copyright scope should be allowed to be that wide. Because if you start allowing, you know, the random walks of ducks in the sand to be considered copyrighted material, things start getting ridiculous pretty quickly.
Okay, two thoughts. Number one, I think that we're bound to see a case like the one that you hypoed out there, Margot, where because people, the grumpy cat people in particular, and other people with internet famous beasts, take them around and display them in public a lot, such that onlookers would take pictures and would post their pictures and might perhaps try to use those pictures in a commercial way, maybe just by having an ad-supported website, for example. So I could definitely see this case coming up in the question of personhood in the right of publicity context coming to the fore, because I can definitely also see the grumpy cat people not be happy, not being happy about people making money off their famous felines brand. Secondly, on a lighter note, CRL in IRC also seems to be have some sort of unusual connection to Naruto, because he has sussed out that what Naruto really wants in the way of damages is a penthouse in Trump Tower. So we'll have to somehow get that to PETA's lawyers. All right, fine. Before we leave the copyright portion of our show and move on to some other related copyright issues in a more entertainment context, although Grumpy Cat is nothing if not entertainment. Just wanted to mention that in the UK, we've seen an interesting extension of their copyright term for industrially manufactured artistic works, going from 25 years, the former copyright, to now life of the designer plus 70 years, various commentators and folks paying attention to this seem to think that this is directly taking aim at 3D printing, so that if folks are governed by having to respect copyrights for life of the designer plus 70 years, if you've got a 3D printer and you're manufacturing furniture or other items at home, that you it would be easier to come after you for infringing on those copyrights, and certainly if you were selling those things. Margot, any thoughts on this?
Yeah, although maybe a little bit indirect, because UK copyright and design law is not really my space. I think that this actually does relate to the case that the US Supreme Court has accepted for cert this term, which is the Star Athletica versus Varsity Brands case. So there's a lot of interesting things to be said about line drawing in general between different types of intellectual property law. And what happened in the UK is that, at least my understanding from the article, is that a particular thing, that is to say a chair, used to be afforded one type of intellectual property protection, which was a design type of protection, which was probably of stronger protection but much shorter duration than copyright. And this act shifted the type of protection the chair was receiving from strong but short protection to much longer copyright protection. And the fear in the UK is that'll prevent 3D printing, because you won't be able to sort of print for yourself at home under copyright the way you could have under the design protection. So the same sort of line drawing problem is arising in the United States, where we do have design patent as one type of intellectual property law that would apply to useful articles. But this case the Supreme Court is considering would basically potentially extend design protection under copyright law, so do a similar shift to what happened in the UK.
And just to remind folks, we've talked about Star Athletica on the show before, and Mike has written about it, but this is the case that the U.S. Supreme Court is going to consider that involves cheerleader uniforms and the use of various chevrons and common design elements that you see in such uniforms. Interesting tie-in with our discussion of Naruto here in his case is that in Star Athletica, too, there is this issue of whether the Supreme Court has any need, want, or desire to defer to what the Copyright Office has said about an issue or opined about an issue. How does that come out? Come up in the Star Athletica case, Margot?
So in Star Athletica, the Copyright Office issued a registration to the two-dimensional designs of the three-dimensional object. If you look in the briefs, there's a great picture of the cheerleading uniform and with its chevrons and whatever the other embellishments are. But it's a drawing. It's not actually a uniform that was submitted. And so the question is, when a court is reviewing the copyrightability of the useful article, does it have to defer to the Copyright Office's decision that this is, in fact, copyrightable?
Mike, any further thoughts before we close this discussion?
No, I don't think so. I guess I'd just point out that when it comes to a copyright being registered with the Copyright Office, it's a non-adversarial process. Quite different from trademark applications and patent applications. It's really ex parte. It's done by the copyright examiner. The copyright examiner says yes or no that you're entitled to or that you've met the legal requirements for a copyright registration. So I guess given that it's really a non-adversarial, non-judicial type of proceeding, it'll be interesting to see how the U.S. Supreme Court grapples with that issue as to how much deference, if any, needs to be given to the Copyright Office through the examination process.
Okay, we're going to discuss some entertainment-related stories in just a moment here. But first, I want to thank our first sponsor for this episode of This Week in Law, which is Wealthfront. You invest for the long term for you or your family's financial health. But trying to do it yourself, especially the right way, is complex and time-consuming. Luckily, we've got Wealthfront. Traditional advisors charge huge fees between 1% and 3% of what they manage. With Wealthfront, though, you pay 0.25% a year. That's 25 basis points, zero commissions, and no hidden fees. That's less than $5 a month to invest a $30,000 account. You've got to just wrap your head around that one. It's practically nothing to manage that amount of money. There are no additional charges for any of Wealthfront's services. With Wealthfront's new portfolio review, you can see if your portfolio is at risk, how diversified your investments are, what you are losing to fees, and even minimize your taxes. You can get started investing today with as little as $500. It only takes a few minutes to sign up. It goes right to work, monitoring your portfolios around the clock, taking action as soon as an opportunity arises. Wealthfront is transparent and accessible. You can view and track all your accounts in one place. Wealthfront can track both your Wealthfront and non-Wealthfront bank and brokerage accounts that they'll provide for you in a summary of all your assets. You can also see every trade that Wealthfront makes on your behalf in your dashboard, on your desktop, or with their mobile app. Wealthfront's process is based on Nobel Prize-winning academic research and the best investment practices. We've heard from many Twit fans who have used Wealthfront and love how they can diversify their portfolios and buy stocks from in-demand companies like Apple, Amazon, and Facebook, all commission-free. Wealthfront recently introduced their 529 college savings plan, which allows you to invest after-tax dollars, much like a Roth IRA, and save for your child or grandchild's higher education expenses. Wealthfront manages almost $3 billion in client assets, and it's growing rapidly every day. So what are you waiting for? Invest for your future today with Wealthfront. Visit wealthfront.com/twill to sign up and get your free personalized investment portfolio. You'll see the customized allocation they recommend for your profile. And just for Twit listeners, if you sign up to invest, Wealthfront will manage your first $15,000 entirely free of charge for life. Join the many Twit fans who have seen huge success with Wealthfront and claim your offer today at wealthfront.com/twill. You've really got to give this a try. Anything under $15,000 is entirely free of charge for life. And don't you think having some investment advice is probably better for you in the long run than just sitting down and thinking, hey, you know, I think Microsoft is sounding good this week. I'll dump some money in there. So invest your money wisely, plan for your future. Thank you so much, Wealthfront, for your support of This Week in Law. All right, let's look at those said entertainment-related stories. I thought I'd bring up the Frank Ocean exclusive on Apple and the fact that once again we've seen how exclusives lead to a bunch of privacy when there's, or, I'm sorry, privacy, piracy, or let's use the more palatable term, unauthorized, potentially infringing downloads, although that's more of a mouthful. When I say piracy, at least you know what I mean. And a lot of folks have pointed out that because Frank Ocean's album was only available on Apple, it was downloaded in an unauthorized, illegal way over 750,000 times, at least probably way more than that now. Somewhat mystifying to me. I do have Apple Music and I listen to Frank Ocean's album and I haven't quite decided that it's my cup of tea musically yet, but it is there on Apple and it's causing people to wonder about this whole strategy of doing exclusives with various streaming services. I'm wondering if you've paid attention to this, Mike, and what are your thoughts?
Oh, I paid attention to it a little bit. Much like a lot of folks, I suppose. Mm-hmm. It's interesting that that UMG is now coming out, taking a hard stance, saying that there will be no more exclusives. Mm-hmm. It's going to be interesting to see if other labels follow suit and what that ultimately means for the industry.
Yeah, it will be really interesting. It seems like other labels would follow suit and try and stem the tide here. At least one author, Josh O'Kane, who has a piece in the Globe and Mail, thinks that part of the motivation for Universal's decision to kill exclusives is a defensive one, trying to justify the existence of major labels with their attendant overhead costs, et cetera, because actually, Frank Ocean's album didn't come out under his usual Def Jam label in its Apple Music form. He speculates that perhaps Ocean fulfilled his obligations to Def Jam in the long video he released the day before, and that the independent label, if that's what it is, Boys Don't Cry, that the album was released under will actually result in a whole lot more money for Frank Ocean himself. So that's all sort of behind the scenes. Why are they doing this? You could certainly see why labels like Universal would like to justify their own existence in an age where it's entirely possible for artists to strike better deals with indie labels or perhaps go direct to their fans. Margo, any thoughts on this?
Yeah, two things. First, I loved the Kanye West quote from Twitter where he said, "Let the kids have the music." Mm-hmm. I think that speaks a lot to what you were saying about the direct causal relationship between these exclusives and increased piracy. So one of the articles that we had said there were 750,000 illegal downloads of Ocean's album, which apparently is more than for non-exclusive releases. The second thought I had, which I think may relate to the Universal Music Group decision too, this whole battle over exclusives especially on streaming platforms, seems to actually be an unintended consequence of shifting from a product-based idea of music to a service-based idea of music consumption. So where we used to have our relationship to music was that we would own a CD, right? You would go, this is like the DMCA, DRM battles of the early 2000s. You'd go to a store, you'd buy the CD, you actually owned the CD, you could sell the CD under for sale doctrine, etc. Now the relationship in music consumption is you pay a monthly fee to have a streaming product. And as one of the articles that we had pointed out, that makes it really difficult to have exclusives and not result in piracy, because you aren't able to just go to a different store and buy another CD. You're having to pay $10 a month and sign up for this service. So the exclusives model combined with the services model of music consumption seems pretty rife with piracy options. And sorry to use the term that you don't like.
It's not that I don't like the term. It's just it's pretty laden. Non-neutral. Yes, exactly. It is more of a mouthful to try and express it in other ways, though. All right. Let's move on and revisit Kim.com. We haven't heard about him in a while. The Mega Upload founder, who is still outside the U.S. I believe he's in New Zealand, right?
Right.
Yeah. I think so, yeah. So attempting to be, there are various folks in the U.S. who very much want him here, including various folks in Hollywood who have lawsuits pending against him. They're attempting to extradite him to the U.S. There was an extradition hearing and his extradition appeal that was streamed live this week on YouTube. And I think the most notable thing about it, I don't think we have an outcome determination yet. I don't think there's been a decision by the court whether he's going to be extradited or not. So stay tuned for that. But the kind of interesting thing about it is he fought so hard to have the extradition appeal live streamed, and then it just proceeded to put everyone to sleep who watched it and give them, you know, a very up close and personal view of how long and drawn out and sometimes really deadly boring legal proceedings can be. So the drama was not as high as I'm sure the viewers would have liked. Any thoughts on this, Mike?
No, there were also, in addition to being rather sedate and boring, apparently, there were all sorts of technological glitches associated with the streaming that further added to, I guess, the tedium of the whole process. So,
right,
and that's interesting to see what happens.
That's very appropriate too, because whenever technology and courtrooms come together, it seems like you have technological glitches that throw things into chaos and commotion. Margo, did you try and watch any of this?
I did not, but I thought these stories were hysterical, in part because, you know, court access is a big deal. Open access to courts, especially involving newer technologies, is a big deal. You have courts across the United States that ban, for example, the use of mobile phones or recording equipment in courts. So good for the New Zealand court that they actually decided to live stream, and hysterically funny that it failed miserably.
Yes, I think that pretty much sums it up. Let us turn now to the fate of the One Ring, or one of the many One Rings, as the case may be. What has happened here is, I believe this took place in Australia. It might have been the UK. I'm not specific. Yeah, no, it's Melbourne, Australia. So, we have a jeweler there in Melbourne, Australia, who, like many, many folks out there, and this is what he attempted unsuccessfully to argue in court, that he's certainly not alone in doing this. His name is Alexander Thomas Saltalamaccia. He was making replicas of the famous ring from The Lord of the Rings, complete with elvish script inscribed on the inside. They were, I do not think, any sort of very precious one ring. They were selling for between $5 and $30 each on eBay and on his jewelry website. And, you know, anybody who is interested in such things can easily do a search on eBay and Etsy and find it, and other places as well, of course, and find that this sort of thing is pretty common. However, the estate of J.R.R. Tolkien came down with all its weight, wrath, and glory upon Alexander Thomas Saltalamaccia, and took him to court successfully. So one of the funniest things about this, aside from his, you know, why pick on me kind of approach, is that all of the rings that he had made had to be destroyed. And of course, you're all thinking what I'm thinking, that somehow they had to find Mount Doom and throw them in. But this is an interesting little item that he was singled out, probably, I'm guessing, simply to find someone to make an example of and say, hey, you know, if you do this, beware that we can and will come after you. So that's what happened to poor Alexander. Mike, what do you think about all this?
Well, I could be wrong on this, but maybe the copyright laws are different down under. They must be, because I'm not so certain that a case like this would go over as successfully here in the U.S. So as I understand it, it was a copyright claim with respect to the ring and the text that was embedded on the ring itself.
Right.
If we're looking at this from a copyright perspective here in the U.S., Of course, a ring is going to be a utilitarian object, I suppose, but it's not going to be original. I mean, these gold rings are not original to Tolkien or his estate. And then, of course, if we're looking at what's on the ring, it's this rather interesting, distinctive font. But fonts aren't protectable under U.S. copyright law. Anyway, so I'm not sure what the copyrightable authorship is here from a U.S. perspective. I'm not sure that the case would ultimately have legs here. But I'd be interested to hear what our great professor has to say about it as well.
Well, how about one ring to rule them all, one ring to find them, one ring to bring them all, and in the darkness bind them? That would at least be a phrase that would be copyrightable under U.S. law, right?
I think that's probably right. Could be.
So, I don't know. It is an interesting case. What do you think, Margo? Would this fly in the U.S.?
So I have to agree. I think you run into de minimis issues in that the Copyright Office, once again, won't register things that are titles or extremely short. So even though it's its own unique language and its own unique font, you may end up having the phrase be too short to be something copyrightable in the United States. But what is interesting about it is that if we have a hard and fast de minimis rule in the U.S., and it's not totally clear that we do, there's a question of whether originality should be taken into consideration when you try to figure out whether something that's really short should still be copyrightable. Because I would say I think a very, very short phrase in an invented language and invented script looks to me to be much more original than your usual attempt to like copyright an English language title.
What if it were invisible and only visible when you threw it into a fire?
You're extending beyond my hypotheticals.
Sorry, had to do it. Let's see, what else can we talk about in the realm of entertainment and entertainers? Twitter's now going to, as though you aren't already inundated with enough advertising and pre-roll ads, Twitter is now going to let individual Twitter users who upload videos opt into putting ads in those videos. Previously, they've done that for companies and entities and more professional video production type enterprises. Now anyone on Twitter, you still have to fill out a form and get approved. But if you want ads in your video, you can do that. Is this a big deal, Mike?
Well, it's not particularly unique or novel. I think what potentially is different about this is, as I understand it, the revenue share is going to be pretty significant. I think like maybe up to 70-30 split with potential advertisers that want to post videos with ads in it. So, you know, I think it's really a movement to try to increase the user base of Twitter and get more attention. So, yeah, I mean, I guess in that sense, it's probably a fairly significant development.
Okay, Margo, any thoughts?
Only that I don't think I've seen a single video via Twitter as a medium. I largely think of it as a text-based medium, and maybe that's just the people that I follow, but it'll be interesting to see how effective this is and how much it actually changes the content on that platform.
And I wonder what the relationship to Vine would be. You can't exactly put ads in a Vine video. I'm guessing that that's completely separate, even though they're the same company. Because people on Vine tend to get their videos chopped up and put into, this is an interesting copyright question. A lot of how Vine is consumed is not on Vine. It's when people take all the, you know, trending, popular, they find some way of linking together various Vines and putting them together into one big, long video. Which itself is a new work that has some distinctiveness based on the selection of what's included, et cetera, et cetera. But I'm surprised that that hasn't been a more controversial practice because it's pretty common. Margo, any thoughts on that?
Yeah, a couple of things. The first thing to come to mind for me when you describe that is actually the Second Circuit case about Prince and the not Prince, the artist, the musical artist, may he rest in peace, but Prince, the graphic artist. Mm-hmm. And the compilations or collages that he made using works from this one gentleman's basically coffee table book. Right. And there the Second Circuit says that kind of mix, even if you don't intend to add any message to the underlying work, that kind of remix can be fair use. Mm-hmm. So there is a question of, you know, if you piece together all these different parts of other people's works, can you end up producing something that's fair use? Now, the big difference is that the Vine communication that you've described, those are entire works. They're not, you know, small clips like the way a collage is. Mm-hmm. And then the other thought on this is Vine itself is probably insulated from all of this through the DMCA.
Right. Okay. I'm ready to move on and take to the skies. I'm going to make sure that when I do so, I'm armored up and protected. So let's talk about some new developments in the world of legislation and policy, and start out by talking about drones. So some very interesting drone stuff this week. First of all, Monday was the day that the highly anticipated small UAS drone rules from the FAA came out, the commercial drone rules. Prior to the rules enacted this week, you had to get specific permission from the FAA to use a drone for commercial purposes, and a limited number of people have gotten such permission. Now it's still a process, and it seems like it's going to be quite a complicated process to navigate if what you want to do is use a drone commercially. But at least there is an avenue for you to get to be able to do that. There is a test that you have to have. There's a pilot certificate that you have to obtain, and you have to register your drone if it is over half a pound in weight and less than 55 pounds. If it's over 55 pounds, I'm not sure exactly what category you fall into then. First of all, I'm not even sure how you get it airborne or how it's not got some sort of military application. But assuming that you are actually using an enormous 55-pound plus drone, I think the FAA does have some mechanisms or guidelines for you to follow, a whole different category to go through there. But since most drones are between half a pound and 55 pounds, that's where you're going to find yourself. And there are a lot of devils in these details. The test itself is really hard. Certainly, you can pass it, but it is somewhere harder than a driver's license, not as hard as a pilot's license, but somewhere in between. Lots of things to know in order to get that certificate. And one of the kickers is, even when you've gotten it, unless you get an exemption from the FAA, and they will consider some exemptions on a case-by-case basis, you have to keep that drone in sight. You have to have line of sight control of it. So these are all very interesting requirements. But Margo, I'm guessing from some of the writing you've done watching this these new rules take effect, that in some ways you don't think they go far enough. Can you tell us why?
Sure. So there's been this ongoing battle about privacy, and I think there's some context that's useful for this. The FAA said way back when that it didn't have any interest in doing any kind of privacy regulations. It wanted to only address safety issues. And so as the process of enacting, or I guess issuing regulations, make it easier for people to use drones or use small drones, that lowering of cost of drone use means it's more likely that you're going to have wider spread privacy violations. And I don't belong to the camp of people who think that this is the FAA's purview, that the agency that's responsible for safety in the sky needs to also be responsible for privacy. But the issue is that there's a pretty significant regulatory gap there, and there doesn't seem to be any other actor that's really stepping in. So you had attempts at the, it's going to be like acronym soup, the NTIA, which is at the Department of Commerce, held a multi-stakeholder negotiation where there were voluntary best practices put forth in May that are voluntary things commercial drone users can do to try not to invade people's privacy. But of course, the big issue there is those are all voluntary. And then I've also been watching as individual states have enacted drone privacy laws ranging from the absolutely ridiculous to the maybe kind of functional. So I guess the sort of interesting development on the FAA side is we've now lowered the hurdles for deciding that you're going to go commercially fly drones without putting in any kind of floor of privacy protection.
Right. So for all of you who've been waiting for these commercial drone rules or sort of holding your breath to know that they were going into effect and expecting your packages to arrive or your food to arrive via drone, that's probably not going to happen anytime soon because of this line of sight requirement. Hard to have packages and long range deliveries happening that way. I don't know that the technology is actually there to be able to let that happen as well. Although we've got some really interesting stories in the discussion points about various ways that drones are being used, things that might be done with them in the future. But the DJI Phantom, one of the most expensive, you know, if you're a commercial videographer, you're likely to be using this thing. It has about a 2-mile range. So again, keeping that in line of sight is probably not terribly easy. It better be a clear day and you better have really sharp eyes. But it's going to be required if that's what, if you're operating under the new drone rules. Any thoughts on the new rules themselves, Mike, before we move into this sensitivity about the lack of privacy regulation on them?
Actually, I did have a question for Margo that kind of ties into the next subject. You know, given that you mentioned that the FAA has decided not to engage in any sort of regulatory oversight with respect to privacy, and no other federal agency is stepping in, does that mean that we're left to for state laws to kick in? And if so, are we potentially running into a potential problem here with conflict between somebody that's complying with FAA guidelines with respect to drone usage and privacy regulation under a state law regime?
The answer is yes. The FAA has actually said that it said that the licensing process itself will involve some form of privacy education. And part of that privacy education is supposed to be to point to drone operators that they're still operating in a heavily regulated realm in some states. In other words, in human language, check your local privacy laws, your state privacy laws, before you go out and fly this thing. Because it actually turns out in a number of states, you cannot use it to record people or private property. Whether I think that's a good idea, again, I think it's a different conversation. But yes, you're right. There's this sort of federalist overlay of regulation on top of your ability to just get a license from the FAA to fly it.
Right. And there are some non-intuitive things in the drone rules, the federal drone rules themselves. And I'm sure, as Margo points out, that there's even more confusion when you start putting in even more strict state and local requirements that may also be in effect. But even in the federal rules themselves, there's a requirement that unless you have an exemption, you're not allowed to fly over groups of people. That's something that's kind of difficult if what you're doing is a videographer for weddings, for example, or independent filmmaking, things like that. So it does seem like you need to look at the fine print and really hone in on what it is you want to be doing commercially with your drone and make sure that just taking the test and getting the certificate and registering your drone is sufficient. It might not be. So definitely pay attention to all of that if you've decided that this is your next career move. Go ahead.
Another question that it wasn't clear to me it relates to the issue on the line of sight requirement.
Yeah.
So I mean, in one sense, it seems like, well, this could be of limited use because, you know, how far can you really see? But can you use like binoculars or some other sort of enhancement to make sure that something is still in the line of sight and you could see it, you know, potentially dozens, if not even more miles away than that? Do the regulations speak to anything like that, Margo, or does it simply have to be with the naked eye or somebody wearing glasses?
Yeah, I'm pretty sure that the regs say that it has to be without any kind of enhancement. What's interesting is, so even though I was talking about the fact that the costs of operating a drone are lowered by these regs, because you used to have to go through this whole crazy process if you were a commercial operator of getting a waiver through the 333 exemption process. Mm-hmm. And now it's easier to do this than it is to do 333. But there are still, as Denise points out, significant restrictions. So visual line of sight means it's still relatively high cost. You can't get out of line of sight. Even just requiring people to go get a license, whether the license is hard or not, you're requiring somebody to get off, you know, their chair and go walk someplace and get a license. It's going to restrict the number of people who end up using these commercially. So the privacy alarmist in me is, you know, only slightly alarmed and not fully alarmed given the restrictions that are in place.
Right. Just wanted to highlight at least one example. I think this is the first example, and it came out the same day the new rules came out, was the granting of an exemption to a drone tech startup called Precision Hawk. They, because they have sought this special exemption to the rules, are able to fly their unmanned aerial vehicles beyond visual line of sight. It's a fixed-wing drone company. The drones are used in agriculture. And so they actually applied and got that exemption. So I guess we're seeing that, you know, if you're able to demonstrate to the FAA that you can safely do this, and I'm assuming, Mike, that the issues that you raised about, yes, it's possible to know where these drones are. It's more than possible to know where they are without having visual line of sight. There's a whole VR component, especially when you get into drone racing and that kind of thing. Even the radio controllers for the drones, if you're not using VR, the controllers, which are really complicated bits of technology themselves, oftentimes either will allow you to see where the sort of like a driver's perspective, if you were a drone's eye perspective of where the object is, either on a screen built into the controller or on a smartphone or iPad kind of screen. So I'm imagining that if there's certainly got to be some sort of technological monitoring of where the drone is, if you're going to get one of these line of sight exemptions. And the other thing I thought was interesting in just watching all this unfold this week is there was an interview with a guy. He's like an aerial safety guy. He was writing at Forbes, and he actually got on the phone with FAA representatives to talk about drone racing and whether drone racing is going to count, whether people are going to have to need to go through the certificate process, et cetera, under these new commercial drone rules. And the FAA sounded like it was telling him, yeah, they will, because with the VR goggles that they use in drone racing, that's not visual line of sight. So you guys are going to have to do... go ahead.
They said that counts as commercial use. That would be the question for me.
They didn't weigh in on that. They didn't weigh in on the financial side of it, although there is, you know, if you win a huge drone race, you're going to have some sort of financial prize. You're going to have sponsorship probably from your team and from sponsors and things. So there is that commercial component of it. But the FAA comments that they gave to this Forbes writer were all on the safety side and saying, visual line of sight is one of the requirements for hobby flying. So if you're not doing that, then you're going to need to take other steps. So the drone racing community, I'm sure, is paying attention to that and, you know, doesn't want their entire burgeoning business to be tanked by the new FAA rules. So I'm sure they're going to figure out what's going on there. One of the things you have to also pay attention to, though, when you're flying around with your drone, let's say you've done everything right. You've passed your test. You've registered your drone. You're up there filming your next great blockbuster. What happens when you stray over somebody's private property in rural Northern Virginia, for example, you happen to be near the home of a popular Godfather starring Hollywood celebrity, Robert Duvall, and you happen to catch Jennifer Youngman out on her porch cleaning her rifles and just waiting for you to wander over her property. Well, what happens in that situation is that Jennifer's going to blast you out of the sky. And that's exactly what happened here. Jennifer is the latest person to shoot a drone down. Kudos on her aim. You know, I'm sure these things are not that easy to hit. It basically was over her property for just a moment. And she decided, yeah, I'm going to take it down. So she did so. It's a fascinating situation because Jennifer and others are concerned with drones wandering into places and taking photos that no one has given them express photos and video that no one has expressly authorized them to do. So, Margo, what do you make of all this? And is Jennifer liable here for the damage to the drone, or was she merely getting a trespassing object off her property?
So, I'm personally really fascinated by these drone self-defense pieces, or I guess stories. There's a fairly good article by, I just want to give a shout out to it, by Michael Frumkin and a student of his, that is about robots and self-defense, or really drones and self-defense, that goes through in great, like, really precise detail when you could possibly shoot a drone down, and be justified under self-defense law. So I think I'd rather talk a little bit more broadly about it. I think it's interesting that this has sort of become a way for people to stand up for their, what they perceive to be their civil liberties, and that the civil liberty of privacy is so intimately tied in for people with the idea of property ownership. So you have this person who has their house, and their house is sort of the core of their ability to exist as a private person in an increasingly less private society. And if you come over their property with this drone, they feel like their right to defend their property includes a right to defend their privacy. Now, the actual, like, legal technicalities of what's going on here, there's this. Did you cover the drone slayer case in Kentucky?
No. Why don't you bring that up?
So there is an ongoing case right now. There was a gentleman who shot down a drone that allegedly was flying over his teenage daughters over his property while his teenage daughters were sunbathing, which is my least favorite fact pattern. But he shoots the drone down. And first thing that happens is he gets sued for destruction of property. And the judge in that case says, no dice, you know, you're basically, this was the local state judge, says you're defending your property, A-OK, trespassing drones can get shot down. Then you have the owner of the drone sue in federal court. And there they said, look, a drone is an aircraft. We have an FAA determination that a drone is an aircraft. And there's federal law that says you cannot shoot down an aircraft. That's a federal crime. So they're seeking for just a declaration from the federal court that this person who, this man who shot down the drone over his property actually committed a federal crime.
Wow. So we're definitely going to see courts continue to grapple with this, and people continue to be really sensitive about drones flying over or even near their property. You know, what if it wasn't on your property, but you could tell that that high definition camera was trained at your upstairs window? I could certainly see somebody getting ticked off about that. Not everyone like Jennifer Youngman. I said she was cleaning her rifles. I'm sorry, I misspoke. She was cleaning her shotguns on her porch and just happened to have them at hand to take the drone down. So I just, you know, word of caution to all of you jumping into the wild world of flying drones around. Jennifer and her ilk are out there. And they're not just in Virginia or Kentucky, you know? I mean, that tends to be where people are a little bit more bold about saying, hey, that thing doesn't belong where it is and I'm going to take it down. But there's no reason why this couldn't or wouldn't happen elsewhere. So just, you know, those advisory rules that Margot mentioned earlier that the FAA has put out, I strongly urge you to read them and follow them so that, you know, if someone does take out your drone, you're at least wearing the white hat when you have to go into court and try and recover damages on that. And I think that's a good time to mention too that AIG, and I'm assuming others, but AIG is the one that I've seen the example of, is offering drone insurance, is actively soliciting you as a drone owner to come and insure your FAA recognized aircraft with them. And they, I looked at this because I was wondering, gee, is that just so if your drone does damage somewhere, is it liability insurance that protects you from lawsuits? It's not just that. It's also insurance for the device itself. So I have no idea what the policy would say about if you wandered onto someone's property and they shot you down, if you'd be covered under those circumstances. But I think under more accidental circumstances, or, you know, we were talking a couple of shows ago about the MIT project that was considering people's culpability in having a self-driving car hit them or not, trying to make that decision. This is kind of one of those circumstances here. You don't want to have the facts that you're working with have you be the criminal in the crosswalk, if it were. Let's look at an example, though. We have a little video, I think, for you of a way that your drone might be taken out and you might want to have insurance for that kind of situation. Even the subjects of your drone footage might be, a threat to you. Here we have an 8-year-old young golfer. She was being filmed to demonstrate her considerable golf skills and managed to just take the drone right out there. I think it took everyone by surprise, but certainly that kind of thing would be an insurable loss, I would imagine. Also, there's a great story I put on my website about, I think this is more for those wedding photography kind of considerations where people might release birds. God forbid someone releases a flock of birds into your drone, or balloons. This particular one was taken out by a balloon. And the thought of the author there is that, if you're going to be in that kind of situation, you might want to start thinking about what you're going to set up in advance with your client for what they can and cannot do that might actually interfere with or take down the drone, and put that in your contract in advance. And I would add to that that you should also think about who should bear the burden of insuring for particular jobs. Maybe if you're a wedding photographer, you would want to carry that insurance. Maybe if you're a cinematographer for a production studio, then you would be looking to them to take care of that financial consideration. Any more thoughts on drones, drone damage, and those who don't want them near their property, Mike?
Well, I do have a question about the federal action that Margot had mentioned involving the drone that was shot down in Kentucky. So there was the parallel state proceeding that was brought, and then the federal action. Was the federal court asked, and has there been a decision in that case yet, Margot, as to is a crime?
Yeah, no decision yet. In a way, I should also explain, the whole filing of that federal case is a little bit of a thumb in the face of the FAA, because as you probably know, the most prominent drone case prior to this point was the action by Raphael Perker, where he challenged the designation of a drone as an aircraft. And Perker, they ended up settling with the FAA, but the FAA basically claimed a drone is an aircraft because it has to be an aircraft in order for us to be able to regulate it at all. And the FAA largely won that. So what this drone slayer case is doing in federal court is saying, okay, FAA, you want to call a drone an aircraft? You have your cake, you eat it too. If it's an aircraft, that means that destruction of it is a violation of federal law. So it'll be really interesting. There's no decision yet. It'll be really interesting to see how that comes out.
And are there claims by the plaintiff in that case that there's damages? It's a curious kind of claim in federal court. Are there regulations that? Yeah. Yeah, because you would think that what would be the federal court's basis for jurisdiction to exercise its jurisdiction to declare that a crime has been committed under the FAA regulations?
You're absolutely correct. There has been the defendant in that case, the drone slayer's attorney / the drone slayer, did point out that there isn't enough money at issue for this to be something where there's federal jurisdiction. So you're right to latch onto that. That's one of the weaknesses of the claim. And that might be how the whole thing gets thrown out.
Okay, just another couple of points to leave you with as we wrap up our drone discussion. If you're thinking that you have a commercial drone and you know, you want to use it for your own financial gain through your business or otherwise, and you're thinking that you're just going to thumb your nose at these FAA requirements and go flying and see what happens, I just wanted to remind you that the FAA has shown that it will fine people. Before this, the new rules took place, you were not allowed to fly drones commercially at all without specific permission from the FAA. And when someone decided to do that anyway and got caught, this began back in 2013, but wound up with the FAA imposing an $1,100 fine on the violator. It can impose fines up to $10,000. So just bear that in mind. Also bear in mind that what the FAA expects to happen from the enactment of its new commercial drone rules is that we will see 600,000 or more commercial drones in the air within a year. So watch the skies. They're about to be slightly more populated. We will now, I think, take a break. Thank our second sponsor for this episode of This Week in Law, which is FreshBooks. Small business owners, it's time to be honest about how you feel when dealing with your day-to-day administrative work. Admit it, you can't stand it. It's a total grind. It's the worst part of what you do. But don't worry about that. We have good tools available for you, and in particular, FreshBooks. The truth is, over 5 million small business owners felt exactly that same way until they discovered FreshBooks. FreshBooks is the dead simple cloud accounting software that's transforming how small business owners handle their paperwork. As far as invoicing goes, you can use FreshBooks to create and send an invoice literally within about 30 seconds. There are no formulas or formatting, just perfectly crafted invoices every time. You can also brand your invoices, set recurring invoices, and attach receipts. You can also accept online payments. Your clients can pay you online, which often means you end up getting paid a lot faster. With FreshBooks, you can set auto payment reminders and snap photos of receipts. There's also a super handy deposit feature, so you can invoice for a payment upfront when you're kicking off a project to make sure that your expenses are covered as you go along. You can also import expenses into FreshBooks automatically. FreshBooks can even show you whether or not a client has looked at the invoice you've emailed. If they're being a little bit slow, you can see whether or not they've received it and looked at it or not. This is only a fraction of what FreshBooks can do for you. You owe it to yourself to feel the full effect of FreshBooks on you and your small business. Also, check out their EMV chip card-enabled card reader. Getting started is simple, and it's totally free for 30 days. Go to freshbooks.com/twill, and don't forget to enter This Week in Law in the How Did You Hear About Us section. Start your 30-day free trial today. Thank you so much, FreshBooks, for your support of This Week in Law. All right, on to hacking elections. Just another bit of news this week as we're winding toward the presidential election here in the United States. The FBI is asking officials across the U.S. to check their own databases for suspicious activity because it appears that foreign hackers have attacked two state election systems. We're not talking about here just the electronic voting kiosks that can be so controversial because they are considered less than secure and available and vulnerable for infiltration. We're talking about large state election databases. Margo, have you looked at this at all?
say, I best bet that what Donald Trump would say is that we should build a wall around these databases.
Yes, that a firewall at the very least. There wasn't much to say about this story, except that, from the law and policy standpoint, certainly it's in everyone's interest to have secure, un-mess-aroundable elections. And it appears that there's some concern here with these state databases and the FBI is investigating. Mike, anything you want to add?
No, I don't think so, other than this kind of helps feed the narrative that from Team Trump, where they've been saying that if he loses, the whole election's going to be rigged. And I think this just kind of adds fuel to that fire. So
yeah, the FBI.
Hopefully the FBI can get to the bottom of this quickly and figure out what's going on here.
Yes, they haven't even released the identity or the country from which they think the hacks originated yet. So something to stay tuned to and keep an eye on. And in the meantime, we will use it as our first MCLE passphrase for this episode of This Week in Law, which will be firewall the election. And we put these phrases into the show in case you are listening for professional credit in the legal or another field. If you head on over to wiki.twit.tv and find our This Week in Law page there, we've got a whole chart for you lawyers out there letting you know how you can submit forms to your oversight body, including This Week in Law, as part of your continuing legal education obligation. We do this just to make it easy for you. We're not making anything off of this. This is just, aside from if you support our sponsors, that's a wonderful thing. But of course, our shows are available online for free and no subscription required. Just find them at our twit.tv/twill page. And we discuss cutting edge legal issues and have wonderful experts on every week to try and understand them. So we think that it's a great opportunity for you, if you enjoy the show, to go ahead and write it down on a list and submit it and let us know how that goes if you're receiving MCLE pass credit for the show. We think that's just wonderful. And we put these passphrases in just in case you need to demonstrate to someone that you actually watched or listened. So little public service for you there. Let us move on. We've been talking about privacy in the context of drones, but let's talk about it in a couple of other contexts as well. So since we're talking about aerial surveillance, let's hit briefly on the story we discussed last week. Once again, the city of Baltimore and its aerial surveillance program, which involves a small plane equipped with sophisticated cameras circling Baltimore at about cloud level and capturing an area roughly 30 square miles and transmitting real-time images to analysts on the ground. I put this in, Margo, just because I noticed it was something you flagged in Twitter that the Baltimore police are going to continue the program. So I thought I'd just pick your brain on that, see what you thought.
Sure. First, just a quick aside. Is my audio still working? Okay.
Yes.
So this is an interesting situation to me for two reasons. One is that the existence of this surveillance program over an entire city and entire, significant chunks of city neighborhood is something that points to inequality of law enforcement. So we have, as happened in 2012, when the same system was run over Compton near LA, we have a surveillance system that's largely being used to target people of color and impoverished populations. And so that should be troubling on its own, that these are being used largely to monitor the activities of those who are least powerful in our legal system. On top of this, I thought in the earlier, longer article, it was interesting that the fellow who came up with this system, who's in Dayton, Ohio, so yay, Ohio, thinks that the whole thing is constitutional and A-OK. And it's surprising to me that the police officers or police departments that are using the system are not paying closer attention to recent Supreme Court jurisprudence around big data. So you have a GPS case, the Jones case, which I'm sure you've discussed many times, which was 2013. And then you have the Riley case, which was the cell phone case, which I think was last summer or last spring. And in both of those cases, you have a majority of the Supreme Court justices saying big data is different when you gather enormous amounts of information about people, even when it's in public, even if it's something that could be held in a wallet traditionally. That data gives rise to inferences about affiliations, about religious behavior, about, you know, the kinds of groups you might go to, the kinds of therapy that you try to receive. And those inferences are incredibly sensitive, even if the underlying data itself might not be sensitive. So you apply that here and you think the idea of putting a tracking system in place, because that's effectively what it is, over an entire population of a city, and thinking that that doesn't implicate any kind of protectable Fourth Amendment interests is kind of mind-boggling to me.
Yeah, that is mind-boggling. And the other, I just can't get out of my head that somewhere in Baltimore, Jennifer Youngman is cleaning her shotguns on the porch and waiting
so,
for
so
that.
One thing I wanted to share that I went and grabbed when we were doing the last commercial is this is my Drone Slayer t-shirt.
Oh, very good.
So available in support of the Kentucky Drone Slayer. I don't make any money off of this.
No, that's awesome. And
can we buy those somewhere?
Yeah, those are available on eBay. So I hope Team Willie, because his name is Willie, I hope he receives an uptick in purchasing after this episode.
No doubt. All right, let's look at Facebook briefly. Really interesting episode that Cash Hill wrote up at Fusion. We have a piece in our rundown that's by... Oh, goodness. Who wrote this particular piece? Also a really good look at this at Fortune.
The Atlantic, right?
No, this one's at Fortune and it's still loading. I'll tell you in a second once it puts its... yes, it's by Jeff John Roberts, who's been on the show with us. That's why I wanted to just give him a shout out. We have this really interesting situation where there was a psychotherapist who's on Facebook. Let's just take it as a given that almost everyone in the United States is either on Facebook or knows someone who's on Facebook. Can we? I think that's probably an anecdotally accurate thing to say. This therapist was on Facebook. Many of the therapist's patients were on Facebook. And this strange thing started happening where the patients started being suggested to one another as possible people. They didn't know each other. They're not doing group therapy. They just happened to be patients of the same therapist. And they started being suggested to one another as people that they might know or should friend, or the algorithm was starting to suggest that they should connect up. And this was obviously very distressing to the therapist, who had never shared her client's information with Facebook. And Cash Hill, who's also been on the show several times, has decided to dig deeper into it and is trying to figure out what happened here. And it seems that at some point... the therapist gave Facebook her cell phone number and that it was matching up numbers with the therapist's address book, which she may have, shared with Facebook. So huge caution, if you are someone who is dealing with people who might be at risk and could be disturbed by having the thought of their therapeutic history be somehow made public or shared with other patients, that this is a big concern. You shouldn't be probably giving Facebook access to your phone contacts, because it will use that information to help others help, quote unquote, others with friend recommendations. Margo, any thoughts on this?
Yes. First, I thought the most interesting point in the article was that there are implications for Facebook announced that it's going to start using the WhatsApp information, contact information. Mm-hmm. So there are implications in this for people who, like me and like the author of the article, don't share their phone numbers with Facebook, but do have to share their phone numbers with WhatsApp. Mm-hmm. Because it now means that you can't protect yourself from Facebook by refusing to give your phone number. The second thing, which is a little bit, you know, less in the weeds, this again points out the way in which sensitive information can be derived from, you know, conceivably non-sensitive information. So from this Facebook algorithm perspective, all it's doing is porting in the contact list that somebody has. That maybe it's doing that with permission, I'm not sure. But it ports in the contact list and tries to connect people. And the sensitive information that it's revealed is that the contact list actually is the contact list belonging to a therapist. So you've now revealed that all these people go to this therapist. Mm-hmm. So same conversation I was just having about Jones and Riley and this idea that big data is in some way different. You can't assume, and if you're the builder of an app, you can't assume that something is non-sensitive or won't result in privacy violations just because the fundamental thing you're dealing with is non-sensitive information.
Right. Yeah. It's something that I think we'll see more and more of. Have you figured out a way to opt out of sharing your phone number with Facebook when the WhatsApp data is shared with Facebook? Is there any sort of remedy for that?
The article suggested there is. I haven't looked into it yet, but mm-hmm. that is something that is on my short list of things to do after this podcast.
Right. There we go. Mike, any thoughts?
Nothing further here. It's frightening, a frightening story. Commended to all of our listeners.
Yes. All right. Since we're talking about Facebook algorithms, and we were talking earlier in the show about the legalities around AI, earlier we were talking about IP rights and who can own and control them. Let's look at torts an AI might commit, and let's look at that under the topic of defamation. So once again, with Facebook here, we have a whole interesting story that unfolded that I'm sure folks have been following. It's sort of tangentially related to legal issues until we get around to the question of whether Facebook's algorithm defamed Megyn Kelly. But to get there, we have to sort of review the fact that Facebook came under fire for having people keeping up its trending topics and doing so in a supposedly biased way. So to address that, Facebook decided to automate that system. And the algorithm itself, unfortunately, had some problems that the people didn't have. Can you tell us more about what happened here, Margo?
So you end up, this reminds me a lot, actually. I'm going to take a quick digression of the Microsoft chatbot. Did you mm-hmm. talk about that?
Yeah. We sure did.
So,
Tay.
Yeah. Tay. So this whole idea that, you know, you create an algorithm, the algorithm is supposed to do some kind of sorting. And if there's any sort of input that you give to users, then it ends up pushing up things you really wish hadn't been pushed up in the newsfeed. Mm-hmm. So that's roughly the same thing that's happening here, right?
Right. So how does Megyn Kelly come into play?
So you end up with Megyn Kelly being terribly insulted during this. And the concern, the fundamental legal concern here is whether Facebook, in fact, it should be considered to be the author of the speech since it's, you know, done via algorithm, or if this is something that Facebook is insulated from.
Mm-hmm. So what happened is there was a fake story and it concerned Megyn Kelly. I'm just sort of trying to get my head around this now. Yes, Facebook allowed the topic Megyn Kelly to trend over this fake story that, again, was someone, you know, as Margo pointed out, people immediately tried to mess with Tay. Similarly, people tried to mess with the algorithm and tried to fill up the trending topics page with their own favorite and not necessarily real story on the topic. So what do you think? You know, Megyn Kelly is insulted. It's the algorithm's fault. Does she have recourse against Facebook?
So there's, again, the big picture description of what's going on here and then the nitty gritty legal details. I actually think the legal details are really interesting. So one of the big problems, if you allow for algorithmically generated speech to be protected under the First Amendment, is what you do with our legal standards for causes of action like defamation. So let's say Megyn Kelly wants to sue Facebook and wants to sue for defamation. Well, the issue is that she's a public figure. She would have to show actual malice on the part of Facebook in publishing this content. And the question is, if Facebook's not actually thinking about what it's publishing and all it's doing is letting this this algorithm generate the results, can that ever constitute actual malice? And the broader way of describing that is, can an algorithm have the necessary intent for our legal standards? And if it can't, then you end up with a legal system that insulates algorithmic speech from liability in a way that it doesn't necessarily insulate human speech, which is a really counterintuitive result.
Right, it sure is. The particular piece in question claimed that Megyn Kelly had been fired from the network because she endorsed Hillary Clinton. It was wrong. She never endorsed Hillary Clinton. She hasn't been fired. And so that is, you know, if somebody came out with that kind of inaccurate speech, that if it were not an algorithm, they did have actual malice here to take into account the fact that Megyn Kelly is a public figure, they could very well be sued for defamation. So do you think that anything will come of this? Do you think this will become our test case or that this will just be an interesting blip that winds up in one of your exam questions, Margo?
I hope that Megyn Kelly is less litigious than Melania Trump. That's all I can say.
yes, we'll just have to stay tuned and see about that. Mike, any thoughts?
I think it's fascinating. I guess to play devil's advocate a little bit here, as I understand the actual malice standard, it's got to be knowingly publishing something false or willful disregard for the truth, something along those lines, right, Margo?
Yeah.
So the argument would be something along these lines that, look, this algorithm was created by Facebook and it allowed the topics to trend with minimal or maybe even no human interaction involvement to see what was trending and to see if it was accurate. So I guess the argument would be by setting up the algorithm, letting it run, due to the fact that this is a public figure that's being defamed, that act in and of itself of kind of recklessly setting that up and not checking to see if what was being published was accurate could potentially be willful disregard for the truth. I guess that would be the argument. I'm not sure if it's ultimately going to be successful, but it raises a fascinating legal question,
yeah,
to be sure.
You're basically in the world of vicarious liability and the First Amendment, right? So this is similar to like the Napster and Grokster conversation, except instead of being a copyright conversation, it's a First Amendment conversation. Mm-hmm. And so the question would be, under First Amendment defamation liability, how much care would Facebook have to take in programming that algorithm for it to escape the actual malice standard? And I should point out also, Facebook should probably be concerned over the conversation around private figures too, because the Megyn Kelly standard, the actual malice standard, is quite difficult. But the standard for defamation when you're talking about somebody who's not a public figure is an easier standard to meet.
I think we'll make Sue the Bot our second MCLE passphrase for this episode of This Week in Law. Getting back to, yeah, vicarious liability and bringing in privacy kinds of copyright kinds of considerations to this defamation discussion, I'm reminded of the discussion you and I had last week, Mike, about the Lens case and whether it's sufficient under the standard enunciated by the Ninth Circuit, to have a crystal ball determine your assessment of whether or not fair use is something you should be concerned about before you send your takedown notice. It seems like for actual malice, we would need a similar statement or standard from the courts that, no, you can't just roll the dice on your algorithm and you can't just consult a crystal ball. You have to do something reasonably careful and cautious here to make sure that what you're publishing is not false. Do you think that we'll see some sort of evolution of the actual malice standard in light of the way that businesses are making publishing decisions?
It's interesting. You mean in the if this case ultimately goes anywhere?
Right. I mean, if this case or some other case says, hey, you know, you're Facebook, you're responsible for what your algorithm is doing.
Yeah, I mean, it seems to me that, you know, as I mentioned, I think it raises a fascinating legal issue. I mean, on the one hand, I could see Facebook saying, look, this is really a technological function. This is the age in which we live. We're just essentially using this technology and serving up what is trending. Therefore, you know, especially if we're dealing with a public figure, that there shouldn't be liability here unless the actual malice standard is met. But on the other hand, it does raise the question of, well, is this a little bit different? Do we need to look at this in maybe a slightly different way? So it'd be interesting to see how this is see what comes of this. And also, we had mentioned last week about the one public figure case that is being I don't believe the court has accepted review of it, but it's being requested to review a case involving the public figure test.
Right. And the other thing, as you're talking that through, Mike, that comes into play, another way we might have to think about this is under the rubric of Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act.
Sure.
Because this is only trending because of what it is being posted to Facebook by its users. So
yeah, this is squarely in the is the website a speaker? Is the website a conduit? Is the website insulated by CDA 230 or not? In this case, it's right there in the middle of all of those issues. I think you're absolutely right.
Right. So, I mean, I guess we go back to the authorities under Section 230 in that, you know, you're protected if all you're doing is publishing what your users are putting on the site. But when you start to get into the mix and exert editorial control, like coming together, bringing together perhaps a trending topic list, that might exempt you from the protection you'd otherwise have there. How do you think that plays out, Margo?
You know, I'm not totally sure. And it's funny because I haven't really thought this through before. I think that, you know, if I think about like Google's search engine results, for example, it seems fairly clear to me that Google has at least First Amendment protection in its search engine results. Mm-hmm. And my guess would be probably also CDA 230 coverage. So yeah, I guess Facebook could also try to use CDA 230 for this.
All
even
right,
though
well,
it's user input in a weirder way than the normal user posting.
Yes. Our supposition is that Megyn Kelly's not going to sue Facebook, but someone might, you know, if they're certainly a big target. And this certainly was the kind of thing that could result in a defamation case in other circumstances, non-automated publishing circumstances. All right. Let us move on to a final topic before we wrap up our show. I just wanted to note something on the trademark front. So if you didn't have enough reasons to want to go to Stanford for your educational needs, they've given you another one. Tyra Banks is going to teach at Stanford, and she's going to teach the subject of brand management and growing your business and your brand at Stanford's Graduate School of Business. So I think it's just an interesting thing to point out. I put it in for you, Mike. I thought you'd get a kick out of Tyra on trademark could be the next treatise that your office is featuring. Any thoughts?
Well, I'd love to be a fly on the wall during the lecture.
Yeah, absolutely. Stanford seems to do a really good job of absolutely providing wonderful education. Business schools in general try and make things practical, and I can think of no one better to talk about the practicalities of brand management than Tyra Banks. So good for them.
No doubt there are.
Bringing her on, yes. All right, we'll go ahead and wrap up our show. We talked before about animal selfies, and like we try and deliver each week, we've got one for you this week. I don't believe this is the first sloth animal selfie we've featured, and it probably won't be the last, but it's a good one. It was taken earlier this year by a tour guide in Brazil. He found a sloth lounging in a tree, as sloths are wont to do. And he had a very long, it looks like telescoping selfie stick that he was able to position above the sloth and get the shot of the sloth with just a wonderful expression on its face and sort of a whoopee attitude of its arms. And the photographer himself at the end of the selfie stick at the bottom taking the great shot. So let's talk about this through the rubric of the Naruto considerations we were discussing earlier. Here, the happy sloth or the disturbed sloth that just happens to have a happy expression on its face was not the photographer. So do we really even have anything to talk about here as far as legal controversy? What do you think, Margo? Name and likeness?
So, right. So first of all, right of appropriation, if we wanted to argue for that. And if, right. You know, wherever the photo's taken, there is a right of publicity that could plausibly extend to a sloth, which there probably isn't. The other thing, though, if you'll humor me for a second, you could bring up the question of whether dance and acting are covered by copyright law, in the sense that does the performer of a gesture or the actor get any kind of authorship claim in the actual fixed work? So this reminds me both of the Google versus Garcia case, where, or Garcia v. Google, where Cindy Lee sues and says that she's actually the author of the Innocence of Muslims, or partial author of the Innocence of Muslims video, because she's an actress in that video. Right. And the Ninth Circuit pretty squarely said, no, you don't get that. But it is actually a complicated question of whether, as long as the performance is fixed, do you as performer get any kind of copyright claim in the performance, even if you weren't the one who did the fixation?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So if your sloth is the dancer or your sloth is the actor, even if the sloth didn't take the picture, maybe the sloth has a copyright claim.
I just feel bad for the sloth because now it's a public figure and it would have to meet the actual malice standard in suing for defamation. And it didn't ask for that. Mike.
Well, the Supreme Court will clarify that, right? That's the case that's up for cert.
Right. Mike, any thoughts?
Well, I think our sloth here may be a joint author. I mean, you got to look at that pose. There's certainly minimal creativity associated with that. And, you know, you've got the actual photographer that, you know, pushed the button on the selfie stick. So, yeah, maybe we've got a joint authorship issue here, too.
Yep, quite possibly. All right. So, happy sloth. We will, I'm sure, have more sloths on the show, aside from just our usual cast of sloths who appear on the show, not including Margo or Mike, of course, just referring to myself. We do have a tip of the week for you that goes back to Jennifer Youngman. There we have more of a gray area about whether she could take down a HD video equipped drone flying over her property. Our tip is simply because you have concerns about photography in public places doesn't mean you get to beat up photographers who are posting to Snapchat, which is what happened in San Francisco. Apparently, there was a photographer who was capturing an accident or the aftermath of an accident where a driver fell asleep at the wheel and drove into the sidewalk. He took out a newsstand, continued into a shoeshine shop. He injured some people. And Peter Muller was the photographer who was capturing the incident. I'm not sure what was in the minds of the people who decided to sucker punch him. But three folks, not just one, but three folks went on to attack this photographer. Apparently, I think they must have felt, I'm just projecting here, I have no idea, but they must have felt like because people were injured or whatever, that he was somehow intruding on the victims here. I don't know what was in their heads, but they attacked him. And Mueller actually prevailed in their scuffle and overpowered one of them and held him down and called the police. And they were already a short distance down the street, probably because the accident had just happened. Anyway, so I just thought this was interesting because of the drone story and the fact that people are very touchy and I think uninformed about photographers in public places and the fact that it's simply not okay to come after someone simply because you object to a camera being there at that time. Margo, any thoughts on this?
Yes. So the very basic thought is please don't hit people. Mm-hmm. The slightly more elevated thought is there are a number of courts around the country who are recognizing a First Amendment right to record. These are largely cases where a police officer is being recorded by an individual who's using their cell phone. And the cases have mainly recognized a right to record in public places matters of public interest. So even though, as I've said earlier, there can be privacy concerns, even in a public place, over having persistent surveillance that follows you over long periods of time, there is a countervailing First Amendment right for people to take those photos. Now, the fact that they have that First Amendment right doesn't really say anything about what you as a private citizen can do to them, but it does suggest that the police can't arrest them for taking those pictures. So I return to my original point, which is please don't hit people.
Yes.
And if you're a police officer, be aware that the First Amendment restricts you from arresting people.
Yes. Very good addenda to our tip of the week. We have a few resources, or just a couple, actually, of resources of the week for you. For those folks who would like to take the plunge and try and comply with the new commercial drone laws, a couple of good pieces for you. One is at CNET by Sean Hollister. It's titled How to Get Your Drone License and Legally Make Money, full of great information about the new rules and the practicalities of getting that license. And then a longer piece at Wired that is titled How to Ace the FAA's New Test and Become a Pro Drone Pilot. That's by Arian Marshall. And it looks more closely at someone's journey who has gone down this road of getting their drone pilot's license and the work that was involved, the resources they had to line up and how to prep for the test and what sort of things you might anticipate on the test. There are sample questions available from the FAA and things. So basically this is more of kind of a study guide, if you will. So both those are there for you. And I did just want to give an update on the Great American Database Hunt, as it was captioned by EFF, something else we featured as a resource of the week recently, something that people could participate in, which was helping EFF aim their browsers at more than 400 database catalogs in California to try and bring some ease of searchability and use to what's in these publicly available databases. And so more than 40 people participated in that project. They found a bunch of information. They had 680 unique agencies searched, 970 searches conducted, 430 agencies in California that had database catalogs online, 250 agencies without database catalogs online, verified by a couple of people participating. They're adding various other databases after the fact, after this took place. So great if you participated, and even if you didn't, interesting information and efforts from the EFF on making California's public records more searchable. And with that, I'd like to thank you all for joining us for the show. It's been a really fun one. Lots of great stuff to discuss. Margo Kaminsky, always great to have you on the show.
Thank you so much. That was really a fun way to spend an afternoon.
It really was. Anything going on at Ohio State that you want to let us know about before we sign off?
Oh, sure. So we actually just started a program on data and governance. We hired a professor, Dennis Hirsch, who is running the program. And we also hired another cyber law faculty member, Brian Choi. So we're trying to really build a center of excellence here on privacy and all things cyber. And I'm really excited to see what comes of that in the next couple of years.
That's very cool. Thanks for sharing that with us. Mike, how about you? Anything going on in your neck of the woods that you want to let us know before we sign off for the day?
Just looking forward to the weekend, and we'll look forward to next week. I should mention a resource that will be forthcoming here soon. I am co-editor of the ABA's forthcoming copyright litigation desk book. It's been a long time in the making over the last few years. We have about 35 different authors that have contributed, and so it will be coming to a bookstore near you, both on available online and through the ABA bookstore. So we're super excited about that.
Oh, that's fantastic. Thanks for letting us know about that. Labor Day weekend is upon us, so be careful as you take out your newly purchased and hopefully newly licensed and permitted drones and fly them around over various celebrations. What else did I want to let you know? We will be back next week. We record the show every Friday at 11 o'clock Pacific time, 1800 UTC, and you can join us live at twit.tv/live if you'd like to be with us at when and as we record the show. That's always fun. We love it when you're playing along with us as an audience. You can jump into IRC and let us know what you're thinking as you're thinking it. It's very helpful for us during the show. We love having that aspect of the recording process. But if you can't do it, don't worry. Don't feel guilty. Just head on over to twit.tv/twill and all of our shows are there. So you can watch them whenever you want, wherever you want, on whatever device you want. All the instructions for doing so are right there, including our entire archive of shows just waiting there for you to delve into. So we hope that you'll do that. We hope that you'll join us next week. We hope that you'll get in touch with us between the shows, because that's a very important part of what we do here at This Week in Law. We talk to you and listen to you and hear from you about things that you think are interesting and that we should be covering or that we haven't heard of yet because we simply haven't stumbled across it or had the time, et cetera, et cetera. Oh, there was one story we didn't get to today that I really, really wanted to get to, and maybe we'll just slip it in here right at the end as I'm wrapping the show. And that
tell
is
me it's kind Pokemon. Of
yes, it's the Pokemon. I totally blipped over that, and it occurred to me because in Labor Day on Labor Day weekend, as you're out flying drones, you're probably also cruising your local park with trying to play Pokemon Go. There's at least one city that is trying to get, I think it's in Michigan. Let me see where I stuck this.
Milwaukee.
Another MI. the city of Milwaukee wants Niantic to obtain a permit for people to play Pokemon Go in its various city parks, raising the very interesting issue of whether a virtual reality, augmented reality game like Pokemon Go should be treated like a real world game like volleyball before you can play it in the park. Margo, I know you had some thoughts on this. Can you share them with us before we head on out?
Yeah, and I'll do this really briefly, but The reason I'm so excited about this is because this is another example, yet another example of embodied speech. So mm-hmm. you have something that's in the virtual world looks just like a speech issue or a traditional sort of CDA 230 type issue. And then the thing that makes it interesting is that it has literal footholds in the physical world. And so there's a long line of First Amendment cases that recognizes the government's ability to regulate speech or really expressive activity like parades when you're in the physical world. And that's because when you're in the physical world, you have physical effects that happen from that kind of expressive activity, like leaving tons of trash places, making too much noise at the wrong hours. And so governments can use these time, place, and manner regulations to regulate that kind of speech that exists in the real world. What's weird about this is that Milwaukee County wants to apply that not to the players of the game, but to the actual makers of the game, Niantic. So mm-hmm. it would make sense to me that you would try to get the players of the game to get some sort of permit to play the game in the park because they're physically going to be in the park. But I'm not sure you can link them to the actual producer of the game to require the producer of the game to get the permit for every single player in every single jurisdiction that happens to wander into every single park in the United States.
Right. It does seem like a strange approach. And what the city is saying is that we want you to take all the Pokestops and gyms out of the parks until you've registered with us and gotten a permit. So they're attempting to sort of hold Niantic hostage in that way. It'll be interesting to see where this goes. Mike, any thoughts?
Seems a little tenuous to me, but it will be interesting to see what happens here.
Right. And I don't even know, you know, where the recourse would be. I guess Niantic would have to, you know, challenge the permit requirement in court. And that's how it would wind up having a court look at this and say, Gino, city, you've exceeded your authority here and it's not required. Or Niantic, go ahead and give them the information they need. They want, according to the city, they want to have some sort of contact overarching responsible party for things that could go wrong while players are playing in the park. And I think that Niantic has bent over backwards to make it clear to users that it is not that overarching responsible party for their conduct. So this will be interesting to see what becomes of it. I'm glad I remembered it right here at the end of the show. We'll keep an eye on it and let you know if anything happens. And in the meantime, please do get in touch with us. Find Mike or me or Emery on Twitter. Emery is busy moving to San Francisco right now. He'll be back with us hopefully next week. So find us there. Email us. We're Mike, Denise, and Emery, respectively, at twit.tv. Give us a shout there. Find us on Facebook or Google Plus. The show has pages in both spots, and just let us know what's on your mind and who you think we should have on, what we should ask them about, and anything else you want to let us know. We'd love to hear from you, and we will see you next week on This Week in Law. Take care.